If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56diva.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
I have a guest here today on the phone, Andrea Pitzer. She's the author of a book, One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps, the most comprehensive book about the human and global story of concentration camps. And I welcome you to the show. Andrea, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Karen. I'm really glad to talk about this because I think it's important for people to sort of know the history behind everything that's happening today.
I really agree with you because I'm an avid traveler, as it sounds like you are. And one of the things that I have learned, if nothing else, is really, besides wearing comfortable shoes, is that you should, you know, really look at the history because history repeats itself. And you see stories in different countries that are very similar to stories in other countries, and different things that have gone wrong go wrong in different countries. I'm going to read a quote from an article that you recently wrote that really got to me. Over the last 130 years, concentration camps have existed on six continents. Monarchies have imposed them. Democracies have embraced them. Communist party-run nations have adopted them. There is no kind of national political ideology that hasn't resorted to them because every culture has fault lines that unscrupulous political actors can use to divide a country's population. So let's start by defining, Andrea, what is your definition of a concentration camp?
Well, I think that's really important so that we at least are in the same universe still talking about the
right.
same thing. And so combining other historians' research with my own, I've defined a concentration camp as the mass detention of civilians. So we're not talking soldiers in POW camps. Mass detention of civilians without real trials, targeting vulnerable groups for political gain, and usually doing so on the basis of ethnicity, race, religion, or political affiliation, rather than for any specific crime that's been committed.
So before we get into the detention facility in Miami, we're all familiar with what happened, you know, in the Holocaust with Auschwitz and Treblinka, where Nazis incarcerated. In fact, actually, interestingly, on my little news feed for This Day in Legal History on August 3rd, 1944, today, Auschwitz concentration camp gassed 4,000 gypsies. 4,000 were killed. Today, August 3rd, 1944. So we know about those things. Tell us what makes this alligator Alcatraz into a concentration camp in your view?
So if we take that definition that I was talking about before, then if we're looking at civilians, right? So we've got civilians. These are not soldiers or armed people. There's sometimes rhetoric about there's an invasion, but legally this has not been holding water so far, even up through the Supreme Court, that this is somehow an armed invasion. These are civilians. And in terms of this real trial, in the Soviet Union, let's say, people were given show trials, but they were not given due process. Or in other places, maybe a judge would wave their hand over 100 people, and they would say, you're guilty of this, right? So not real trials. And what's happening at the Everglades concentration camp, as I'm calling it, is that there are judges that are being put in a boot camp that are not people who have experience with immigration court whatsoever, and they are being put through this short-term, few-week-long boot camp with the idea that they are going to be bringing people to this place en masse, giving them sort of instant hearings, and then putting them on an airplane out of the country. And the whole reason for doing that is to avoid the actual due process that they are owed by law. As Constitution has been interpreted for many, many, many decades, we have seen these rulings that provide anyone on U.S. soil with some of these rights. And there's an end run around these rights that is trying to that people are trying to make take place right now, and that is one of the other parts of the definition of a concentration camp. Whatever the legal system that exists in that country at that time, these camps have to be kind of pasted to the side of it, and there's an end run around what is the normal process. And some people would say, well, you're saying it's not for any crimes committed, you know, that, but these people cross the border. And one thing that I would really want to say to that that's important is that Hitler spent the first 5 years in Nazi Germany trying to turn Jews into illegal aliens so they could do whatever they wanted to them. They made it impossible to be in the country legally so that they would be able to charge whoever they wanted and round up whoever they wanted in the long run. And I see very similar patterns to the ways that every single action that immigrants take can be weaponized and used to charge them. But unless they've been convicted, they're still not criminals.
And, you know, this article in the front page of our Tribune, you know, it was just horrendous. There were women, they're not giving them food, they're not giving them water, you know, toiletries. They have like one jacket they're sharing, they're sleeping on cement floors, they're cold. I think, you know, there are a lot of people that can view this as those are other people. Those are not us. That's not me. You did something wrong, therefore we don't care about you. But, you know, I look at our criminal defendants and people who have been convicted. They get three meals a day. They have heat in their cells. They have blankets. They have to, otherwise they're going to have a lawsuit. And even just our Idaho murderer who got sentenced 10 days ago or so, you know, he's sleeping in a bed. And a lot of people say, well, he doesn't deserve to live, but that's not the way our law works. These people are being treated worse than criminals. Is that fair to say?
That's absolutely fair to say. And one of the things that people who have studied concentration camps across many, many decades from many backgrounds have shown is that generally if you are in, you know, you are in a concentration camp, if you would be better off committing a crime and being tried and going to jail for that crime, you would have more rights. So
wow.
Literally what you just said is one of the definitions, and that is true here. I mean, what we're hearing specifically from the Everglades is maggots in the food, lack of access to water, flooding, sewage backup, lack of respect for someone who wanted to read the Bible that they had brought with them. And I'll give you one other story that is just an incredible thing to me. I predicted right after the Everglades detention facility was built that because of the dangerousness of mosquitoes in that region and how prevalent they were, that they would actually become part of the harm that would be happening to the detainees there. And the Miami Herald ran a story just last week that people there were being tortured with mosquitoes, that the guards were making them be outside, exposed, shirtless, to thousands and thousands of mosquitoes for hours, and they were begging to come back in. And I literally, the week before this story came out, had done a like 17-point list of different countries around the world in camp detention and how they used mosquitoes to abuse the detainees. And then it was here a week later already happening in the Everglades. So, yes, conditions there are terrible, and they're going to get much worse if we don't put the brakes on this.
I don't know where you come up with people who are that sadistic to do that. I mean, it's just hard to believe that any person who's not an antisocial personality, is somebody who is a good moral person, even just a okay moral person, could do that. But just, and we're going to have to take a break in about 45 seconds, but does this kind of breed people who do these kinds of things? Like you start out with an inhumane system and it turns people like guards into inhumane beings?
So it takes years of propaganda and cultivating the population and then culling another group of people willing to do that harm. It doesn't happen overnight, but it takes years and years of work to do it. But if you use that propaganda, you will create the population who will do that to their neighbors.
We are talking to Andrea Pitzer. She is the author of One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps. You have gone to different places to look at these concentration camps. And with all of your experience and studying it and talking to people and standing in these facilities, what do you glean? What are some of the generalizations you can share with our listeners?
Well, the first one I'll just touch on that we hit before is just that idea that this isn't something that's just part of human nature. It has to be really pushed by a government or party, and it takes time to find that vulnerable group, to turn people against them, and that with propaganda you can do that anywhere. And the second thing I would say is that every single camp system I studied, literally from the first one that was called a concentration camp, when it came to the second one that was a concentration camp, that second party in power in England at that time said, oh, no, our camps, those the camps we want to put these whole groups of people into, they aren't like those other bad camps you're thinking of. Our camps are humane, and what's more, you know, this group of people we want to detain, these guys really are that bad. They are inhuman monsters. And I got to tell you, there is not one case I've studied around the world in across that 130-year span where those statements were true. But every time, whoever's in power, the government, the leader, the party, is always saying that same thing, and it's just never true.
Well, and it's interesting. I don't even know that the administration here is saying that. I think, you know, they don't. I don't think there's an idea that, hey, you know, facilities are safe. The facilities are great. They're really wonderful. It's like, no, I don't even think that is being said. I think they're relishing the idea that it's in the middle of a swamp, that they're, you know, that it's cold and it's hot and it's difficult. I think there's an idea out there that these people need to be punished, even though most of them have not committed crimes.
Well, and that's one of my concerns, actually. I'm glad you brought it up, is that normally they don't move away from, a government doesn't move away from our camps are humane until 3 or 4 years into the process, but we are already to that point. You know, we saw some of that our camps are humane language, our detention is humane along the border. And let me just be clear, I'm mentioning right here that this was during the first Trump administration, but this kind of language, this our camps are humane, our detention is humane, is something we have seen from the last several presidents in the U.S. This language around detaining immigrants and this need to show a certain kind of cruelty while also saying that we're giving everybody sort of the best chance they can have and we're doing it in good conditions. There has been this really mixed and uncomfortable and I would say inhumane language that has just taken root in the U.S. It's not dependent on any particular individual president. And that is a big piece of what has delivered us to where we are today.
Let's get off topic just a little bit, and we'll come back, I'm sure. But I, as I tell my listeners all the time, I've traveled quite a bit, over 50 countries, and I have been to concentration camps. And a lot, there are a lot of people out there who say, I really don't want to do that. I don't want that scar on my psyche. It's too damaging to go there. It's not something I want to do. It's dark tourism or whatever they call it. I will tell you, though, standing in a concentration camp, you get a real feel that is very different from reading about it. When you visited these places, Andrea, tell us what your feelings were, you know, when you went. Maybe you can give me an example of one particular place that really moved you.
Well, one thing I would just say is that to see and remember this history is critical because there's always going to be people who will try to say things didn't happen, right? And the more people who have seen the place that it happened in and can sort of speak to that, the better for humanity. And it's important that the people who suffered and died in camps, you know, that you remember they didn't do so just to be part of your selfie. So, I mean, you want to be respectful in how
right.
you go.
Right.
But for me, you know, Auschwitz was incredibly powerful to actually see where this death factory had been assembled, to see the shoes or the belongings of the people that were murdered en masse. That was huge. I will also say it was powerful for me. I went to Guantanamo twice, and I also went into, in Myanmar, the camps for Rohingya Muslims that had been sort of pulled out of this one whole part of society in that country and put into these camps. And in both those cases, seeing something that's open right now where people were detained had a tremendous effect in terms of realizing this is part of an ongoing tradition.
The one of the concentration camps that I'm a little bit familiar with, but I'd like you to talk about it, is something in our own country. And I don't know why it doesn't get as much conversation as it should. And that is the internment camps for the Japanese in the 1940s. Can you tell our listeners a little bit of the history of those camps and what happened?
Sure. So after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which was a tremendous shock in the U.S., there's a lot of anger and fury. There was a lot of fear. There was a worry that there were spies everywhere, particularly Japanese or Japanese-American spies in the U.S., and there was a bit of a panic around that. And I think that's where most people's sort of knowledge of it stops, that like, okay, and then they were locked up. But there's a lot of things people don't realize, that these more than 100,000 people who were sent into camps, first of all, the vast majority of them were actually U.S. citizens. They were American citizens, and their citizenship was essentially stripped from them so that they could be sent to these camps. The government broke the promise of citizenship, the deepest promise that a government can have to its people, to force this whole group out of society along the West Coast and lock them up. And then the other thing, and my grandfather, whose crowning point in his life was fighting in World War II, and, you know, we had to have talks about this because he really believed there was this idea at the time that it had to be done, that there was, people didn't know better, that there was nothing else that could be done in that moment. But in the research that I did, I found that Navy intelligence had done this big report in the months after Pearl Harbor. There were other key people in government at the time. They looked at the issue, and they knew, and they actually tried to tell other people that doing these camps would be a terrible idea. It would be destructive and might actually create spies in the country. But as with camps always, it was politically expedient to do it, because after this humiliation of the U.S., after Pearl Harbor, there were some other political reasons in California at the time as well, but people could benefit from it. And this group was vulnerable in that moment because of these actions that Japan had taken, completely independent of the people who went into the camps. And I don't think we've come to grips with what a wrong thing that that was, what a betrayal it was, but also how normalizing rounding up whole groups of people in the 20th century helped set the stage for other things that happened too.
I have a texter who says, Karen, the illegal immigrants have committed a crime by not going through the legal process. They have broken the law. How do you respond to that?
What I would say is, first of all, you can't have broken the law until you've ruled, like there's been a court hearing or you have pled guilty. Like, you don't just, somebody doesn't get to just say, you broke the law, we're locking you up. There is a process that happens, and that's called due process. And that process is partly what I'm talking about here in terms of what's been violated. And the other thing to know about that is, well, it's two things. One is that if that person did that, it's a misdemeanor. And misdemeanors are not normally things that we make people pay for by giving them mosquito tortures and maggots in their food and mistreating them in the ways that we're seeing people mistreated in these detention facilities. And then the third thing I would say also is that there is this, when you're talking about this kind of detention, we are making it impossible for people to follow the law exactly as we've told them to follow it. We are putting them in camps because they're showing up for their immigration hearings. We are putting them in camps because they're showing up for their green card hearings. Because they want to detain so many people and meet a quota, they are literally arresting people from hospitals, from outside schools, from immigration hearings. We are not letting them follow the law in the way that we've told them to follow it, to do the process that the caller very reasonably wants people to follow.
I'm just going to read a couple of these texters. Karen, these people are given their chance to get home with money and avoid the whole process if they know that's what they face. How do you respond to that, Andrea?
That, in fact, I would say that many of these people, when we actually read the reports of what's happening, when you hear their lawyers and other people weigh in, some people volunteered to be deported after they were detained and held in some of these conditions. In some cases, even before, they wouldn't be allowed to be deported. If they had been rounded up as part of one of these quotas, they were not allowed to be let go. So again, between the people who might even be willing to self-deport and the ones who are not given up opportunity, or the ones who have had legal status that then has been yanked away, we as a country are not in any way being clear about what the process is and what should be happening. And when we have leaders that are saying things like, we're going to deport 20 million, and there aren't even 20 million undocumented people in the U.S., the message becomes different than follow the law and do the right thing and come in the right way. The answer becomes America for Americans only, and nobody else that they don't consider Americans should be here. And that is the kind of rhetoric that we're getting to today. If there aren't 20 million undocumented people in the U.S. that they're talking about deporting, if those numbers don't exist, who are they going to be deporting? They're going to be deporting people who are trying to follow the rules and doing the right thing. And once you throw all those people in a pot together, we can't tell the criminals, people we need to get out, from the people that had a legal path that we just took away from them, from the people that maybe they should have a hearing and be sent out of the country. We have no way to tell what we're even doing at this point.
We have a couple of texters who said, you're right about visiting concentration camps. I did not want to visit a concentration camp in Germany, and she did, and it was just life-changing. Someone said they visited Normandy, Treblinka, and the Berlin Wall. I will throw in there Cambodia, going to the killing fields where, you know, a country where I think it was about a quarter of the population was executed by Pol Pot, and to actually stand there and see where people were detained. It is a very moving thing, and it really is different than reading about it or even watching a movie about it. And I suggest, again, for people who don't think they want to do that because it's too harsh, it is very important to experience it and to actually be on the grounds and understand what it's like, because we as humans, sometimes it's, Andrea, I don't know if you felt this, you know, when you were doing your research going to these different facilities, but it's easier just to say, that's what somebody else did. That's what happened somewhere else. Yes, that was bad. My heart goes out, but I don't really understand it, and I can look away. But when you're there, you can't look away. I don't know if that makes sense. Did you get that feeling when you were at all these facilities?
Yeah, you just realize that there's no perfect protection against this, that this can be made to happen anywhere. And for me, that makes, like, protecting our freedoms so much more important to try to keep that kind of history happening. And for you were saying, like, you know, will this scar your psyche? And maybe somebody says they don't want that. I would say, yes, don't subject yourself to something that's going to crush you. You know yourself better than anybody else. But this might be something that's worth getting a small scar on your psyche. That's like that cut you got when something happened that reminds you of, like, what you need to do to take care and what you need to do to be careful. And as a society, I think we need more of that.
Can you give us just a quick idea of what concentration camps are in existence now, maybe in the last 20 years or so?
So there's a lot of stuff happening around borders in the last 20 years or so. And so those Rohingya camps that I talked about, for that minority Muslim group, they have been portrayed in Burma, also known as Myanmar, as illegal aliens. And for the last really like 40 years, they've been forced out of this whole western part of the country. And they're in camps on the other side of the border. They're in camps on the Myanmar side of the border. So that's one place. We just saw India stripping a whole bunch of people in the border state of Assam of their citizenship. We see the Chinese in Xinjiang province, which is a border region for them, with what are absolutely gulag-style concentration camps that have been put in place for the Uyghur minority that's there. But I will also say that what we see in the West a lot of is border detention like the U.S. is doing, and border detention like Europe is doing with Syrian refugees from the war. And in Europe, a lot of those Western countries are outsourcing to other countries. You get things like Australia after, around the time the U.S. was responding to 9/11, started outsourcing its immigrant detention to the island of Nauru and to a facility called Manus. And in both cases, people were held in horrific and monstrous situations in which there were diseases that happened and suicides and sexual abuse and all kinds of stuff. And I think the world, and I realize this is a huge step, we're going to have to find better ways to deal with border detention than creating these kinds of camps, because it puts the entire countries that are doing it at risk. When you do it to one population, we've seen historically again and again, after you do it to one group, it is so much easier to expand it and include other groups. And a government, every government wants power to some degree. Governments are going to do it to more and more people to keep more and more power for the people that are against them staying there. So it's this border crisis that's happening all over the world, leads to this camp situation, which can destabilize freedoms in a lot of countries.
I have a texter, I'm not going to read it verbatim, but who's finding this conversation maybe distasteful because his or her family came from a concentration camp, and that when you liken what's going on in Florida to a concentration camp, there's no comparison. Why is she wrong? And do you think she's wrong?
So I don't know exactly where her family was. I do want to clarify, and I do think it's really important to underline, so I'm glad that person wrote, to say that the camps that were put in place in the second half of World War II in Nazi Germany, the death camps, were an add-on to the existing concentration camp facilities and camps that had been there for almost a decade at that point. And those death camps have never been repeated anywhere else in the world. Those death factories, when we talk about Auschwitz, for example, as we were earlier, those have never happened again. But what has happened again and again is those 9 years of Nazi camps before the death camps were put in place, places like Dachau, Sachsenhausen, that all over Germany and then in other parts of Europe as well, we have absolutely seen those same kinds of concentration camps in many places around the world. That is in no way to minimize the Holocaust, which is a singular event that happened in terms of those mass killings in the back half of World War II, but it was made possible by those prior camps. Those kinds of prior camps have existed all over, and those very mosquito torture stories that I was mentioning earlier, all those kinds of things come out of those earlier forms of camps, and that is absolutely what's happening in Florida today. And I say that as somebody who regularly accounts for my research to groups at synagogues, to Holocaust research centers, to Holocaust studies programs around the country. So I'm not trying to avoid that question whatsoever. And I think it is important to talk about the singularity of the Holocaust, but to understand it didn't spring up out of nothing. It had 40 years of roots that allowed us to get to that point. And my whole goal with this book is to keep us from repeating that history that so devastated your listeners' family.
And I'm not even going to ask you to address this, but I do want to mention this this conversation without mention of the first people living on reservations in the United States. And yes, I'm sure you cover that in your book, Andrea, but we have so little time. But I do want to ask you, what can we do if people are upset about this type of thing? What is it that we can do? Are there certain reputable charities where people can donate money? What kinds of political action are you advocating?
Well, what historically has helped undo the harm that is happening in this kind of detention is to keep the ability to express dissent and protest so that the government doesn't squelch that, and to make sure you're protecting people's freedom to speak out. And the other thing is to help protect due process and courtroom and legal procedures and rule of law. So if there are groups that are representing people who are detained, then getting those people due process is a huge part of it, but also speaking out, speaking up, let your elected representatives know how you feel about this. Let them know you want every citizen and non-citizen's civil rights protected. Not that you're guaranteeing everybody gets to move to the U.S., but you are saying people will have their rights protected. And if you can do those two things, it can make a real difference.
Andrea Pitzer, thank you so much. The book is One Long Night, A Global History of Concentration Camps, available on Amazon. Thank you for your time. Take care.